Your agency body should review Chinese and other foreign entities that come to raise money in the U.S. capital markets. Companies and their subsidiaries would have to be vetted by intelligence, diplomatic, and military representatives. No doubt the finance industry, fueled by trillions of dollars, would lobby hard against any investment restrictions. But if we are serious about making sure our capital markets are not used against us, we have no choice. Similarly, cash from American retirement and pension funds has been used to stoke China's war machine for decades, as money managers use their members' nest eggs to invest in the China market. This means the funds of patriotic Americans, citizens with relatives in our armed forces, are being used to strengthen the enemies of our military. Ideally, individuals who contribute to these pension plans should make their voices heard and lobby pension fund managers to divest in stocks that feed China's military. But it's a safe bet that most members of a pension plan aren't aware of the nuances of its portfolio. To build awareness and responsible investing, the government needs to create a campaign to inform our citizens of how U.S. dollars are being used against our own interests. Lists of bad actor companies should be distributed to all financial institutions. As far as stopping China from lording it over Taiwan, Vietnam, and Korea in the South China Sea, we now have a solution: asymmetrical warfare. That's military speak for deploying unexpected tactics. With the termination of the non-proliferation treaty with Russia, we can build long-range and mid-range ballistic missiles and deploy them with our allies. We can also deploy mobile missile units, the asymmetrical twist, which will prevent China from knowing where our missiles are. Together with an upgraded command and control system, we will go from an imbalance to deterrence. If China has no idea where these missiles are, and they believe we have no compunction about using them, which is something we must convey, then we are in a position to prevent conflict. The nuclear option. My biggest fear as we seek to balance our economic relationship is that the PLA is unrestricted. Therefore, we need the threat of nuclear bombs as deterrence. The assumption, of course, is that these arms will never be used. But invoking fear of the unthinkable, the madman or wild man theory of negotiation, often works. Look at North Korea. Kim Jong-un, a puppet leader completely controlled by China. If China shut its borders with North Korea, there is little question the nation would descend into chaos and starvation, has two bargaining chips: a massive army that threatens South Korea, and a nuclear bomb. His threats to use that bomb have sometimes spurred negotiations. By the same token, President Trump's unpredictable nature may actually help in this regard. A president who puts all options on the table, as scary as that may be, is a good deterrent. Promoting the general welfare. China's strategy has worked so well for several decades because it reinforces a narrative that is pumped out by American business schools. Increasing shareholder value is the first commandment of building fiscal strength. Period. This philosophy feeds into China's strategy because they use it to justify continued investment in their economy and in partnership with corporate America. Since free trade leads to wealth and wealth leads to democracy, according to the misguided logic the CCP wants to promote, then tariffs must be bad. By allowing China into the WTO, the CCP was able to use reduced tariffs to garner American investment to grow its global empire. When tariffs were placed on China in 2018, that meant that lax regulation, poor environmental laws, and horrible employment conditions were not enough to encourage continued U.S. investment. Unfortunately, when U.S. investment goes to other countries, businesses often reward nations that emulate the CCP model by exploiting workers and polluting the environment. This is how the CCP exports its model, by showing it works as a manipulative tool. Other nations copy it, and the free world continues to shrink. to stop the growth of totalitarianism, the tariffs on China and other nations that abuse international laws need to be made permanent. When that happens, investment will flow back into the U.S. Already, the U.S. has some of the lowest energy costs, corporate tax rates, and regulation in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. But corporations need stability, and they will not make investments in America and put Americans back to work unless they know they do not have a choice to go somewhere else where they can avoid following the rules for profit. Until the tariffs are made permanent, countries like China will not start following the rules because they aren't penalized for doing so. Since corporate America only cares about maximizing shareholder value, they are going to argue against tariffs on nations that break the rules because they need the higher margins that business in these sparsely regulated areas permits. This is how the unholy alliance between the CCP and corporate America was created and is perpetrated. It is also why American wages have been stagnant for decades and we have so many unemployed in the country. Good governance starts at home. Infiltration and influence are China's modi operandi. The CCP seeks to control outcomes by working within organizations and outside of them. It uses investment. It uses manpower. It is an insidious and brilliant setup that is designed to use economic power to achieve desired outcomes. Because money talks, and because it is hard to prove that a business deal 8,000 miles away has affected a political decision in Washington, D.C., policing Chinese influence is difficult. But there are a number of steps governments can take to limit the appearance of improper behavior. Federal, state, and city government officials and their families should be subject to best practices. These would include making public disclosures about any ties to China or Chinese-owned companies. Ideally, politicians should be required to put their holdings in blind trusts while in public service. While this may be difficult and subject to criticism for being anti-competitive and restrictive, too bad. Nobody is forcing anyone to run for office or serve in the government. Members of the U.S. military are held to higher ethical standards than our government officials. Adultery, for instance, is a criminal offense according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Given China's rampant influencing campaigns, U.S. politicians and public servants need to be held to a higher standard for the nation's security. To that point, congressmen should take a pledge to wait 5 years after leaving office before becoming lobbyists. All too often, politicians run to K Street to cash in. They want to be influencers. They want to profit by shaping laws to benefit outside forces, including Chinese firms and the Chinese government. We need to be vigilant and reactive. We also need to assure U.S. businesses that government agencies will maintain their anonymity when they report a theft or attack, unless the attack jeopardizes consumer security from a data breach. These companies are being assaulted. Police protect the identities of assault victims, and our government needs to let businesses know that their identities will be protected if they report attacks. A new media matrix. We need to develop Chinese language media alternatives, both domestically and abroad, to combat the CCP's current worldwide monopoly on Chinese language news and entertainment. The goal of these alternatives should be to develop independent content that provides alternative viewpoints for the Chinese-speaking audience. Right now, China is piping an unopposed flow of anti-Western propaganda around the world. Opposition views, debate, free speech, discussion of democracy or religion, these things do not exist on government-monitored newspapers, websites, TV shows, or radio broadcasts. The U.S. government should promote and protect investments in Chinese language media while shutting down all broadcasts of Chinese Communist Party TV and radio channels in the United States as sanctions for China's flagrant violations of, pick one, international trade law, copyright protections, human rights, internet protocols, or standard accounting practices. To keep incidents like the Voice of America scandal from silencing dissidents like Gong, the United States needs to relaunch the U.S. Information Agency, USIA, a government agency created by President Eisenhower that is responsible for what is called public diplomacy. The VOA was part of USIA, but in 1999, the agency was shuttered and folded into the State Department, which practices private diplomacy. These two practices are polar opposites of the diplomacy game and should be kept separate. Right now, if China doesn't like what the VOA is doing, it can complain to the State Department and ask contacts there to use their influence over the VOA. Separating the two organizations would allow each to do what it does best. The government should also close all Confucius institutes and stop issuing visas to staff of these outposts of academic intimidation. Immigration alteration. The flood of bad actors from China is a systemic problem. Right now, immigration officers at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing and our consulates in various Chinese cities have about 30 seconds to evaluate an applicant. This may sound ridiculous and implausible, like some sort of bad bureaucratic joke, but it is the truth. I witnessed the processing process as defense attaché in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. The immigration clerks face an impossible task. How can they interview prospective temporary residents and perform due diligence research to confirm visa applicants' identities in half a minute? They can't. The vast majority of applicants are simply handed 10-year visas. China loves sending us their people. They see it as a win-win situation. It's another export for them of the one product of which they have a huge surplus, people. And many of them come to work for American companies, which not only pay salaries to these Chinese citizens, but also provide them with access to American technology, American computer codes, American patents. None of this is to suggest that every Chinese person who comes to America is a spy on a CCP-sanctioned mission. It goes without saying that many are just hardworking people in search of a good job or a better life. And the issue here isn't some unbridled anti-Chinese form of xenophobia. It is, as I hope this book has made abundantly clear, that the CCP believes in and practices unrestricted warfare against the United States. We know the CCP sponsors corporate theft. We know it allows and promotes piracy. We know about its all-out drive to transfer technology from west to east. We know the PLA sponsors data raids. All these hostile acts were and are carried out by Chinese citizens. I am in no way suggesting we ban the Chinese from coming here or advocating a mass deportation of those who are here. But facts are facts. The State Department needs to devote time and energy to improving its vetting process. It needs to slow down and be thorough. Are visa applicants CCP members? Do they have CCP family members? Do they work in the telecom or technology sphere? Verifying the answers to these questions is essential if we are serious about protecting our country's resources. One last ominous thought on this subject. By introducing social credit scores, China now has, theoretically and logically, another lever to influence and control the Chinese expatriate community in the United States. Chinese citizens could conceivably be pressured to forward corporate secrets, industrial designs, anything really, or risk having their score, or even the score of family members back home, lowered. 9 million people with low scores have been blocked from buying domestic airplane tickets, and 3 million people have been barred from buying business class tickets, according to Business Insider. Dog owners with low scores have reportedly had their dogs taken away. This is a powerful social control lever, and there is no reason to think the CCP won't use it to manipulate its citizens abroad. Combat global international aid loan sharking. While China amasses cash investments from the West, it is using that money to practice dollar diplomacy to influence the leaders of African, South American, Asian, and even European nations. The Hambantota port in Sri Lanka is one of its most overt power plays. China-backed firms loaned money and services to construct the port and then, like predatory loan sharks, seized control of the entire operation for the next 100 years. But Sri Lanka is only one of dozens of developing nations that China is helping while clearly helping itself. Rectifying this situation requires a number of responses, from diplomatic outreach to ensuring that U.S. investments and non-governmental organizations' loans to China are not diverted to pay for foreign aid projects. But our State Department and non-governmental aid organizations also need to learn a lesson in nation building. We need long-term engagement projects that improve society and develop alliances that strengthen local economies and increase democratic stability. Helping communities have potable water is great, but our aid should never end with one-off projects. China's model actually provides a good example of what U.S. foreign aid and development should look like. Congress funds water projects for different countries, but there is no overarching strategy for helping these countries develop and then connecting them to U.S. markets by encouraging U.S. entrepreneurs to build businesses. Unfortunately, U.S. development projects frequently fail in this regard. Power Africa is a public-private partnership launched by USAID in 2013 that aims to light up Africa. It is a terrific idea that seeks to improve conditions in sub-Saharan Africa, where 70% of the population lives without easy access to electricity. The program has projects in more than 24 countries, including Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Nigeria, Senegal, and South Africa. But we need to be doing more than just building power stations and laying power lines. Chinese telecom companies have factories in Ethiopia. The Chinese built a rail line in Kenya and have reportedly been making inroads on constructing a new port for the East African nation. We need to stop fighting and start building. We should take a page from the CCP's strategy and build up countries that can stand as arsenals for democracy in the region. It requires a concentrated focus on aligning democratic principles with free market principles. Each step of the development process can help to reinforce transparency and openness. Meanwhile, if investment and growth opportunities surface during these aid projects, why shouldn't this activity actually benefit American entrepreneurs, since we are the ones paying? It makes no sense to enhance infrastructure and then abandon our work and let Chinese competitors reap the benefits. We need a strategy of building, not breaking, to generate profits for our development partners and our businesses that invest in them. There are other economic strings that can be pulled to help emerging nations and to shape hearts and minds to embrace democratic society. Former U.S. Ambassador to El Salvador, Charles L. Glazer, notes that in many South American countries, speaking English provides a significant lift in standard of living, and that just developing and promoting free online English lessons would be a major win. Meanwhile, when it comes to influencing operations, Glazer says that 20% of El Salvador's gross domestic product comes from remittances sent by Salvadoran immigrants in the United States. He believes that South and Central American immigrant communities in the States could help shape political realities back home. Finally, the United States can and should reassert the Monroe Doctrine when it comes to China's activities in the Americas. For years, Chinese fishing vessels have violated international law by illegally trawling in our South American neighbors' waters. Some of these nations lack naval and Coast Guard defenses. By invoking the Monroe Doctrine, the nearly 200-year-old policy asserting that the United States reserves the right to protect its interests in South America from foreign meddling, we can assure our South American allies that we will help patrol their waters and, if necessary, blow up boats engaged in illegal fishing. If this seems like a hard line point, it is. China has demonstrated it has no intention of respecting international law or stopping its companies from overfishing or stealing and counterfeiting because it has not experienced any repercussions or penalties for the illegal behavior it supports. A National Infrastructure Bank. When states and cities begin investing in infrastructure, they will choose projects and start accepting bids for these jobs. Until China opens up its economy, allows free trade, and stops breaking international trade law, no company with ownership ties to China should be awarded contracts here in the United States. It's that simple. The idea that Chinese companies, all of which are essentially controlled by the CCP, should have access to the plans of our municipal transportation, water systems, or power grids is, to my mind, governmental malfeasance at best. But really, it borders on being traitorous. Awarding domestic work or handing plans to Chinese firms is an invitation to disaster. Ironically, the U.S. government is urging other countries to be vigilant and cautious about working with telecom companies like Huawei. U.S. corporations and local governments need to heed this advice, too. While China has poured money and resources into its roads, cities, ports, airports, and industry, America's infrastructure has been crumbling. In 2013, the American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE, gave America's infrastructure a grade of D+. Since then, very little has happened in terms of a national initiative to improve our roads, dams, drinking water, energy, and other vital systems. Not surprisingly, the ASCE handed out the same grade in 2017. America needs an estimated $5 trillion over the next 10 years to rectify a multitude of issues. Despite the fact that infrastructural stability is essential to both our national economy and our national security, federal, state, and local governments cannot pay for it. Our once robust national economy, which once provided a tax base to pay for investments in our communities, has been offshored, a victim of globalization. Our factories no longer hum with productivity. Our investment culture is focused on stocks and instant return on investment. Increasing shareholder value is somehow seen as more important than national security or our society's well-being. How then can we generate funds to make the improvements that are so greatly needed? I have been working with members of the financial community on creating something called the Infrastructure Bank for America. Instead of leaning on our cash-strapped federal government for funding, we create an institution that acts as a low-cost lender and clearinghouse for infrastructure projects throughout the United States, both directly and through state and local governments. Under proposed legislation in Congress, the Infrastructure Bank for America Act, H.R. 3977, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System would have oversight and supervisory authority over the bank. Here are the nuts and bolts of the bill. The bank shall provide, 1. Direct loans and loan guarantees to private entities for the construction or maintenance of revenue-producing infrastructure projects, and 2. Indirect loans and loan guarantees to state and local governments and state infrastructure banks for the construction or maintenance of infrastructure projects. At least 7% of the dollar amount of the loans and loan guarantees shall be for infrastructure projects in rural areas. The bank itself will be funded by domestic and foreign sources as well as private and government funds. One idea is to offer a tax holiday for repatriated foreign earnings used to back bank bonds and offer tax credits for initial equity investors in the infrastructure bank. This is a private endeavor to solve a national problem. We need more of them to address the issue of finding the cash to fix our society. Infrastructure investment will pay enormous dividends for the United States. The projects will boost employment, increase national productivity, and improve the national tax base, as more workers earning more money means increased revenues at the state and federal levels. There is a historical precedent for a national infrastructure bank. In 1934, New Deal legislators passed the National Housing Act. It had two goals: stop the run of housing foreclosures by providing access to cash, and spur home ownership and construction growth by essentially creating a federal bank to issue low-cost home mortgages in the form of the Federal Home Loan Bank, FHL Bank System. America's housing stock went on a run that has never been duplicated. The act established construction standards and provided money to ensure that those standards were met. The result was the creation of the best housing stock in the world. We need something similar. FHL banks are private, with private funding and management. They are not subject to political influence and ensure a steady flow of funds into the housing industry. While one of the operating goals of the Infrastructure Bank for America is to offer low-interest loans for public and private development, I believe that money managers and corporations will see this as a steady opportunity and a necessity to invest in our nation's stability, standard of living, and security. Those returns alone speak for themselves. Listening to this chapter, it may seem at first blush that confronting the Chinese Communist Party's unrestricted war is an enormous and enormously complicated task. In reality, however, there is nothing to stop us from implementing these protections except our own division, greed, and complacency. We need to counter that with urgency, patriotism, and concern for our collective welfare. Here, then, is a distilled list of key strategic steps to help ensure our future and our children's birthright of freedom. 1. Discourage or ban investments in IPOs and bonds of Chinese firms or their subsidiaries, especially companies that feed the CCP's unrestricted war. 2. Create the market conditions for companies like Samsung and Ericsson to locate secure manufacturing facilities in the United States. This will help ensure that no back doors through which to steal or sabotage communications are inserted. 3. Incentivize American investment in infrastructure and manufacturing in the United States. This can be done in multiple ways: by establishing a national infrastructure bank, offering tax breaks, backing industrial and infrastructure bonds, and making tariffs for rule breakers and unfair traders permanent. 4. Regulate 5G implementation to comply with strict national security standards. We need a secure information network capable of encrypting all communications. 5. Immediately fund a C4ISR network, the state-of-the-art command and control system for the Pacific, to maintain national security. Then begin manufacture and deployment of a mobile missile system with our Asian allies. 6. Create a government agency specifically to inform the civilian population, the business community, and our allies about the threats China poses to our democracy and basic freedoms. This agency should launch a national campaign equating fiduciary and investment strategy with national security. Corporate board members, stockholders, pension fund managers, and investment houses need to understand China's massive economic influence operations and their own role as enablers of our enemy. We need a massive campaign to create awareness that investing in China, among the most repressive closed societies on the planet, is investing in tyranny. In the age of fake news, disinformation, and hacked transmissions, we need to institute a way to certify documents and reports as authentic. One way might be a form of blockchain, a peer-to-peer program in which any changes to a document or program are listed on the document itself. 7. Prevent Chinese influence by creating an intra-agency clearance agency that vets politicians, policymakers, government workers, and foreign investors for connections to the CCP and its many wings. 8. Redefine our relationship with developing nations around the globe for long-term collaborative engagement to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative. We must also reassert ourselves with regard to multilateral finance agencies like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to prevent China from using these agencies as their own piggy bank. 9. Forge a new consensus with like-minded democracies on free trade, democratic principles, rule of law, human rights, and self-determination. 10. Reinvent our military. We are spending too much on bombs and bullets. Instead, we need to shift our military spending toward infrastructure, manufacturing, STEM, and research and design. We should focus on 5G, artificial intelligence, and quantum computing. 11. Bolster the status of U.S. Cyber Command. It should become the 6th division of our armed forces, joining the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, and Coast Guard. Chapter 11. Beating China at its own game. America and the world at large are at an inflection point. China's stealth war is now entering its 3rd decade of active measures. Its goal of becoming the dominant global power by 2049, 100 years after the CCP took power, is now within shouting distance and seems within its grasp. America and the new global economy have been complicit, often unwittingly, in aiding China's rise. The good news is that China's plans are no longer hiding in plain sight. It is now up to our government, our politicians, and our financial leaders to act in the interests of our nation and the principles that have defined American society. There are 4 key concepts that America and the West must adopt to thwart the CCP's lethal threat to our open society. But before I share them, I want to revisit one of the most critical and defining moments in American history. It will, I hope, provide a framework for and telling perspective on the challenge ahead. On January 6th, 1941, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave his annual State of the Union address. It was not so much an update on the state of America as it was an update on the state of the world under assault by Hitler. By summarizing the threats, Roosevelt was clearly preparing our nation for war. Privately, Roosevelt had long regarded the United States' entry into World War II as inevitable. He had urged Congress to lift the arms sale embargo to England in 1939, declaring that the nation must become the great arsenal of democracy. He had urged American manufacturers to prepare for war. Now the president was taking his case to the nation, using the speech as a tool to confront dramatic truths about Hitler's war on the democratic way of life, either by arms or by secret spreading of poisonous propaganda by those who seek to destroy unity and promote discord in nations that are still at peace. It addressed the dangers of isolationism. It even wrapped urgency in humor. As a nation, we may take pride in the fact that we are soft-hearted, but we cannot afford to be soft-headed. The speech's defining moment came in its closing minutes. In the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon 4 essential human freedoms, Roosevelt intoned. Then he listed them. Freedom of speech and expression. Freedom of every person to worship God in his own way. Freedom from want. Freedom from fear. After listing each inalienable liberty, he added the phrase, anywhere in the world, to underscore the idea that these weren't just American rights. They were human rights, and every person in every country should be entitled to them. This declaration, breathtaking in its simplicity and its scope, is why Roosevelt's address is now generally known as the 4 Freedoms speech. It was prophetic on a number of fronts. Almost exactly 11 months to the day Roosevelt outlined his vision, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, and America officially went to war, fighting against fascism and for the freedoms that have been at the heart of our society. When World War II ended, Roosevelt's Four Freedoms became the bedrock from which the Atlantic Charter and the United Nations Charter sprang. Roosevelt believed in a coalition of nations working together to ensure these freedoms. His speech even dismissed the idea of America marching alone to single-handed victory. In times like these, it is immature, and incidentally untrue, for anybody to brag that an unprepared America, single-handed and with one hand tied behind its back, can hold off the whole world. Instead, he called for an international system characterized by rule of law and governed by peaceful dialogue. The United States still supports the principles embodied by the Four Freedoms. Two of them are embedded in our Constitution. The world, however, has fundamentally changed. In today's fully globalized reality, we are seeing the fragmentation and destruction of a codified, principled system. Anyone charting the flow of money and influence across the planet will find national governments intersecting and competing on the international stage with not only rival nations, but multinational corporations, non-governmental organizations, criminal enterprises, and terrorist groups, all working at the speed of light in a free-for-all battle for profits, power, and control. No nation opposes the Four Freedoms with the vehemence of China, and no nation has fed so parasitically on the globalized system to increase its economic and military power while appearing to conform to the rules and norms it seeks to undermine. Freedom from want, the ability to achieve economic stability, is the only thing the CCP offers its own people. And while that particular liberty is a vitally important tenet that many in the West need to remember, it should never be viewed as the only essential human right. Speech, ideas, religion, the press, these cherished fundamentals of liberty are considered the enemy of the Chinese Communist Party. They are even specified in party literature as a threat to the enduring power of the CCP. And this brings us to the last of Roosevelt's critical liberties, freedom from fear. The CCP, despite adopting an always amicable win-win external message to the world, governs not by rule of law, but by fear. It seeks to control its citizens, literally outlawing ideas, behaviors, self-expression. There is little doubt that the CCP is eager to export its totalitarian vision of what people can and cannot do. It monitors its own citizens' behavior, social media posts and likes, purchases, emails, through digital means. And it monitors social media around the world. It is clear, or it should be after everything documented in the preceding pages, that the CCP will mine personal data across the globe to further its ability to influence and control economic and political outcomes. Given the Chinese global influencing campaign and an ideological mania that advocates cheating, stealing, bribing, and repression to acquire economic and military power, there is one section of Roosevelt's speech that truly bears repeating. He is talking, of course, of the threat posed by Nazi Germany. "I find it unhappily necessary to report that the future and the safety of our country and of our democracy are overwhelmingly involved in events far beyond our borders. Armed defense of democratic existence is now being gallantly waged in four continents. If that defense fails, all the population and all the resources of Europe, Asia, Africa, and Australasia will be dominated by the conquerors. Let us remember that the total of these populations and their resources in those four continents greatly exceeds the sum total of the population and the resources of the whole of the Western Hemisphere many times over." The same dramatic conditions apply today, except that if our defense against China fails, you can add North and South America to the list of continents that will be dominated by the conquerors. This passage is equally relevant today because China's repressive treatment of its citizens borders on what can only be called post-Nazism. its banning of religion, its surveillance and incarceration of its Muslim Uyghur and Tibetan Buddhist populations, its surveillance of its own citizens at home and abroad, its jailing of dissidents, its focus on the supreme power of the state. These are all updates on Hitler's vision to control the world. The only difference, really, is that instead of blitzkriegs, military power, and holocausts, China invades and conquers by subversive means, harnessing economic power, illegal technology transfer, cyber aggression, infrastructural control, political chicanery, and yes, upgraded military deployments. Stopping China's unrestricted war will take single-minded focus across the United States and with our allies across the globe. The future of freedom is at stake. But winning this war means fighting it from within our own borders. I estimate that we have 3 years to act. If the United States fails to disentangle ourselves from China's complex web of influencing campaigns, if we fail to curb our investments or solve our infrastructure problems, if we don't protect our citizens by providing meaningful work or ensure the security and privacy of data with the same zeal that China exhibits to acquire it, if we don't rewrite the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act to ensure legal protections for corporations doing business in and with China, if Congress and the Supreme Court fail to revisit legislation preventing cash from pouring into political campaigns to taint and influence the electorate, we will fall prey to Chinese policy at home and abroad, and we will, ultimately, lose the four freedoms. China's actions to date have been cloaked in a web of deceit. Just think of the examples cited in these pages of a worker being fired for liking a tweet, a controversial U.S. government-funded broadcast being silenced, a congressman posing for a photo opportunity to pump up China's image regarding Tibet. But these subversive anti-American acts grow more visible each day as the CCP gains confidence. Eventually, our politicians will become warped by China's infiltrations, and the dam will burst. Yes, our Constitution will provide some protections, but that assumes that the political process can become immune to China influencing. And as we've seen, China will do whatever it takes to ensure the outcomes it desires. In many ways, some of our leaders are already compromised. As I write this, Joe Biden is running in the 2020 presidential race. Anything he might say about a firewall between him and his investor son when it comes to China should be regarded with a healthy dose of skepticism. I say that with the utmost respect for Biden. I don't believe he would knowingly sell out America. But I do believe he is mistaken, like so many others in Washington, when it comes to China's end game and how it seeks to ingrain itself in our economic culture to obtain technology and political power. Otherwise, he would have urged his son to walk away from heading a Bank of China-financed investment fund. Unless anyone think I'm just targeting a Democrat, I refer you to the opening chapter of this book that details Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell and his wife Elaine Chao, the current Secretary of Transportation. Their relations with China are even more entangled and suspect than Biden's. The President of the United States, whoever it may be, needs to understand that China is the friendliest enemy in the world. A country that will smile and come bearing gifts for you and then rob you blind. That's what it did when Clinton and Gore, Bush and Cheney, and Obama and Biden were in office. We need leaders who understand the duplicity and the threats and will act accordingly. The 2020 presidential election looms as an opportunity to seize the balance of power, to reshape America and protect the West, indeed the entire world, from a totalitarian future where the four freedoms will not even be allowed to be mentioned. This is actually a huge opportunity for America, a chance to reset and redress the investor class decisions to abandon manufacturing and with it so many of our cities. As a matter of policy, making China a national issue and taking the necessary steps to defend our innovation, ideas, information, and capital will fix a great deal of what has plagued the United States for the past 40 years. At root, we need an overarching strategy driven by four basic concepts. One, lead with principles. Asserting the legitimacy of the four freedoms, the United States must enforce unilaterally if necessary, but multilaterally when able, the rules and norms of the international trade system by withholding access to our society and economy, or directly punishing those who abuse it. We will reunite free market principles and democratic norms. Two, strengthen America. The national infrastructure must be rebuilt, military superiority reestablished, borders secured, and people cared for, all while regaining control of our fiscal future. Three, organize to compete. The 21st century requires a government fully enmeshed in the information and digital age. That government must support and protect our innovation at all costs. It must be capable of detecting digital theft, piracy, financial abuse, and valuation fraud. And it must work closely with the private sector to ensure the economic vitality and security of our industrial base. Four, rebuild the international order. The idea of principled order supported by the four freedoms is fundamentally sound. It is today's international order that is unequal to the task of maintenance. The tools developed using the free world's innovation, ideas, information, and capital must be devoted toward the shared monitoring and enforcement that can propel the new consensus to permanent peace. Our government, our political parties, need to work together. This is a nonpartisan issue. It's not about which party is in control. In Roosevelt's speech, which I hope every single candidate everywhere studies, he lays out his plan for the nation, specifically decrying the politics of division by repeating the phrase, without regard to partisanship, three times. A China strategy needs to be adopted across the board by the President, the Senate, the House, the Supreme Court, and the people of America. By creating infrastructure, by earmarking money for R&D, by mandating that certain products vital to national security must be manufactured in the United States, the government will enable job creation and technological innovation. By balancing environmental requirements with common sense enforcement, we can address climate change concerns as well. These policy changes will result in national dividends. The return of domestic manufacturing means we will rejuvenate local economies, and instead of being exported to pay for labor costs, money spent on local workers' salaries will remain in the United States, and some of it will be taxable. And that is okay. It will be used to create more infrastructure and to rebuild our military. It's easy to forget that fighting wars has costs. Roosevelt laid that reality on the line. I have called for personal sacrifice. I am assured of the willingness of almost all Americans to respond to that call. A part of the sacrifice means the payment of more money in taxes. In my budget message, I shall recommend that a greater portion of this great defense program be paid for from taxation than we are paying today. No person should try or be allowed to get rich out of this program, and the principle of tax payments in accordance with ability to pay should be constantly before our eyes to guide our legislation. If the Congress maintains these principles, the voters, putting patriotism ahead of pocketbooks, will give you their applause. So, an aggressive China policy will require political, patriotic unity. It has to. But that is just the beginning. Combating China's economic warfare will require business unusual, a radical change in how our society thinks about fiduciary responsibility. Regulators need to reorder the incentive system so Wall Street, corporate America, and institutional investors will change the current culture and mindset that focuses on profits, growth, and stock valuation as the only measures of success. That isn't to say the rules and motives of trade must be radically altered. It's to say that providing capital to China is a fool's game, and until things change, not only wastes money but incentivizes our competitors, who seek to co-opt U.S. market share and earnings. Billions and billions of investor dollars are tied up in China. I've already told you the story of the banker who lies awake at night wondering how we will get our money back. He is not alone. Corporations, huge multinational institutions that have leapt headfirst into China are faced with the same problem. They don't discuss the fact that they can't actually move millions of dollars out of China because if they did, that would upset shareholders and result in lower, sometimes much lower, valuations. That kind of thing costs CEOs their jobs. It also will cost investors billions in losses. Seen in this light, it becomes clear that pouring money into the Ponzi scheme of China abdicates fiduciary responsibility. Profits that exist only in China and can't be converted into transferable currency are not, in any traditional sense, profits. There are other reasons powerful companies need to take their operations out of China. By moving research, development, and manufacturing there, they cede control of their intellectual property, which, as the past 30 years have demonstrated, will be stolen or co-opted. This, in effect, devalues the company. China's non-existent environmental standards and worker protections also diminish the value of a company. It risks becoming complicit in worker and environmental abuse. Furthermore, as the United States does a better job of exposing China's sinister goals, these companies run a financial risk. If redressing China becomes part of government policy, as it must, it seems likely there will be a movement to divest in companies doing business there. As for Wall Street brokerages, which make commissions on every and any trade, they need to stop cheerleading for China. Of course, brokerages have a vested interest in cheerleading. Every transaction results in a trade commission, and so new markets, new listings, new bonds mean greater earnings. But every dollar sent to China further enables their ability to be bad actors and destabilize the West. I've said it twice, but it bears repeating. Would Wall Street have floated German bonds during World War II? Would institutional investors have bought them? Never in a million years. Wall Street needs to acknowledge that the United States is engaged in an economic war with China and that by promoting investment in Chinese companies, which are ultimately owned by the CCP, it is funding the enemy. This may be an uncomfortable fact, but it is a fact. If Wall Street will not police itself, government regulation will have to ensure that our citizens are not being cheated by financial institutions engaging in unfree trade. The SEC, Department of Commerce, the FASB, the PCAOB, the Treasury, the State Department, and the FBI will have to monitor the markets, the bad actors, the cyber attacks, the property thefts, and the piracy. China has engaged in these activities for decades, restricting the flow of capital, participating in accounting and valuation abuses, stealing intellectual property with impunity. America needs a national policy to stop what can only be called bad business as usual. Wall Street trading houses aren't the only institutions that need to change. Our government agencies, the U.S. military, the State Department, the intelligence community, must also transform themselves. The rubber stamping of visas for Chinese citizens must be stopped. 10-year visas must cease. These visitors should be encouraged to celebrate America's freedoms, but they should also be monitored. And while that sounds awful, this is not America being repressive. This is America being reactive to a nation that has stated that all its citizens may be called on to aid Chinese intelligence operations. When China changes, when it plays fair, when it stops its culture of unchecked theft, of unrestricted warfare, of bullying its own citizens, then we can discuss liberalizing our immigration programs for Chinese nationals. Meanwhile, as Roosevelt said, we can't do this alone. If the United States restricts capital investments in China, but European banks open their coffers, China will have no need to reform. Ditto for the oil-rich nations of the Gulf. So America must engage its allies in multilateral institutions and educate them about China's unrestricted war. It must work with like-minded nations to show the World Trade Organization, the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and other organizations the unassailable evidence of China's hostile and often criminal bad faith actions. Too often China plays at seeming compliant, but this is an act that masks a determined and calculated violation of international principles. That act tears at the fabric of the modern connected world. It doesn't just destabilize the United States. No free state should involuntarily cede the bounty of its open societies, innovation, ideas, information, and capital to a repressive rival nation that rejects basic human rights and seeks to prevent free competition in its markets. I am a father. Like every dad, I want to see my kids grow and prosper. But I am frightened by the future. I am a former Air Force officer who pledged to serve my nation in a nonpartisan fashion. I still operate that way. And I admit that for a long time, I was part of the problem. Believing China to be, at worst, a benign partner, I also hope to one day do business with Chinese companies. After my Air Force career, I wanted to move back to Shanghai and, like everyone else, get rich. I am thankful for Second Sight. I used to scoff, like many, at critiques of our society that lay the blame for its many problems at the feet of big business or our federal government. I don't scoff anymore. America was blinded by profits. As noted earlier, power brokers in London and New York decided to use slave labor in China to sell cheap products to unemployed people. It's snowballed from there, and China capitalized on a world driven by profits, greed, and the mantra of increasing shareholder value. There is plenty of blame to go around, but I'm more interested in solutions. And if this book sometimes dwells on politicians or companies that have dropped the ball or missed the boat when it comes to understanding China, it's probably because I'm trying to explain how we got here. Or because I am beyond frustrated. Our founders aspired to forge a more perfect union, and they gave us a guide in the form of our Constitution, which has allowed us to evolve over two centuries toward that more perfect state. I remain moved by the vision of freedom that has inspired this country. That vision is now imperiled. When finding markets, generating shareholder value, and growing revenues on an endless stream of stock and bond transactions become more important than protecting our birthright of freedom and our national security, we have a very serious problem. I pray that this book finds an audience of Americans and citizens of other freedom-loving nations who feel as I do about the Bill of Rights and Roosevelt's humanitarian four freedoms. That is why I wrote this book. As someone who loves the miracle that is the United States of America, a country that celebrates freedom, not just on July 4th, but every day, as we live as we want, think what we want, love who we want, say what we want, and pray to whoever we want. We need to work harder, faster, and smarter than ever before to ensure that we remain the land of liberty. I believe we can, but only if our leaders adopt a strategy that is more aggressive than that of our rivals, and only if we, as a nation, are prepared to sacrifice short-term investment fund profits and access to cheap goods for a future that guarantees our freedoms. To me, the choice is a no-brainer. Actually, it isn't even a choice. There is only one way forward until China stops its relentless aggression. We must stop China's power grab at all costs, or prepare to live in a society where the government can arrest you for possessing the very book you're listening to, or any book. The Bible, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, Fahrenheit 451, or Winnie the Pooh. Why? Because they don't approve of the content. because the very freedom to think has been outlawed. This is Ray Porter. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept, by Brigadier General Robert Spalding, U.S. Air Force retired, with Seth Kaufman. This program was directed by Joseph Grimm, executive producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2019 by General Robert Spalding, U.S. Air Force retired. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.